Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
Good evening and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know. You can find the Commonwealth Club on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. I'm Dan Quigley from the Horizons Foundation, which is the world's first community foundation for the lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender communities, and has raised and provided over $25 million in support to LGBT charities in the Bay Area and beyond since 1980. I am also a former member of the Board of Governors at the Commonwealth Club of California and the chair for today's program. It is my privilege to introduce our moderator, Scott Schaefer, host and reporter of KQED San Francisco's The California Report, and our distinguished speaker, former Congressman Barney Frank of Massachusetts, to this evening's audience in downtown San Francisco. Congressman Frank has been in public service for over four decades. He has been a champion of many causes, ranging from financial reform to a variety of anti-discrimination causes, including protecting the rights of members of the gay community and of women. He was the fearless chairman of the House Financial Services Committee during one of the most difficult economic crises in our country's history. He helped devise and pass what the Washington Post called the most sweeping overhaul of the nation's financial and regulatory system since the Great Depression. He's an ardent Democrat whose commitment to fairness and pragmatism have earned him praise from many Republican colleagues and from President George W. Bush's Treasury Secretary, Henry Paulson. In 1987, Barney Frank became the first member of Congress to come out voluntarily as gay, and in 2012, he married his longtime partner, James Reddy, who is here today, becoming the first sitting member of Congress to marry someone of the same gender. He chose not to run for re-election in 2012 and has now retired from Congress after serving over 30 years representing the state of Massachusetts. Barney Frank is a teacher, author, and a Harvard graduate who hails from Bayonne, New Jersey. I am sure he is missed by many on Capitol Hill, as he was considered among the smartest and certainly the funniest members of Congress. We are grateful that he has come to California to share his wisdom and his wit with us tonight. Please welcome Barney Frank and Scott Schaefer.
Well, Congressman, you've been a private citizen now for about 5 months, and I was just sitting here looking out the window at Alcatraz, and it's a gorgeous day in San Francisco, and I was just wondering, do you feel, being out of Congress, do you feel a little bit like being out of prison, or do you miss it?
Well, it's both. I did, first of all, want to express my appreciation, not just to the club, but at my age, it is wonderful to see so many people whose attention span obviously greatly exceeds a tweet. I wasn't sure that I would ever see that again, and you make an old man very happy. I'm also pleased to note that I will be preceded by a man for whom I have a great admiration, Willie Brown, and I gather it's now clear to me you choose based on political acumen and sartorial excellence. And I'm very glad I wore my nice tie today to be in Willie's tradition. I miss the friends I had, and one of the things that does not come across is the high quality of most of the people who serve in the Congress. I think, frankly, there's been a problem lately with some of the people who are elected who have a kind of extremist view, but up until then, I had a great number of people on both sides of the aisle I admired, and in particular, I miss the service of an extraordinarily talented and dedicated group of people. The greatest bargain the American people get are the staffs of members of Congress who work at enormously hard jobs under very difficult circumstances. So I miss that. On the other hand, after 45 years in this business, I'll be honest with you, when the phone rings, it is a great relief for me to know that it's not someone who has a problem that they want me to help resolve. I mean, that's essentially it. I'll be honest, you start out in the line of work I chose, and you're very eager to make this world a better place, and I still am, but in a different way, because people would call me for years, and my response was, how can I help you? And over time, I will confess that it gradually evolved into, why are you bothering me? And as you cross the line from how can I help you to why are you bothering me, it is time to let someone else take it on. I miss the opportunity, the leverage to make things better, although in recent years, none of us really had that. But it's outweighed. I very much, it's the freedom from stress that I greatly...
Yeah. You mentioned the great staff, and a lot of those staff, especially on committees like the one you served on for so long, go into lobbying. Did you think about that at all?
Personally, no. By the way, most of them don't, and I have to say, and even some of them who do, committee staffs get a bad rap in general. People talk about people on the public payroll, including those, by the way, who work not just on committee staffs. You know, your local members of Congress have people who sit in their offices, and they're in the grief business, by which I mean nobody calls them up and says, look, I want you to know my Social Security check arrived. My kid's having a great time in the Army. The small business contract was wonderful. People call them up to complain. This went wrong, that went wrong. They have a right to do that, but I admire the...
Well, they're looking for help, too.
Yes, and they're entitled to it and should get it. I never considered lobbying for a couple of reasons. First of all, if I wanted to be concerned with legislation, I would have stayed there to do it myself. And secondly, I don't mean to be critical of others, but having had the freedom to do what I thought was right for so long, it just was inconceivable to me that I would suddenly stay in the same line of work, not suddenly, I'd stay in the same line of work, but have other people tell me what my goals were. I just could not do that. And finally, the thing about lobbying, one of the things that you have to do in the job I had, both with regard to the voters and with regard to your colleagues, and to some extent with the media, although I think they have less of a claim, but you have to be nice to people you do not like. That comes more easily to some people than others. And I could not imagine leaving this great job where I was free to do what I thought was the right thing to do to improve the quality of life, and then at somebody else's behest, have to be nice to those same people I didn't like.
Yeah. And you're living in Maine now, is that right?
My husband, Jim, who's there, yeah. Who was just acknowledged, had lived in Maine. I lived in Massachusetts. He's in southern Maine. It's about an hour and 20 minutes, an hour and a half from the two residences. And I'll continue to be a dual resident, but this year in particular, I'm trying to write a book. And so Maine is a great place in the town of Algonquin to spend my time up there writing.
So you can have coffee with Stephen King or
more
something.
More time in Maine. I hope my characters will be a little less bizarre than his.
Yeah, than Stephen King's. Yeah.
But Stephen King.
Does Washington look does Washington look different, you know, now that you're out of there?
It doesn't look different this year from last year. It is different than it was before, and there's a very... It's not as different. I mean, it has been radically different for the past couple of years, not for as long as people say. And I'm very pleased you asked that, because people say, well, it broke down, it doesn't work. From 2007 to 2010, I was chairman of the Committee on Financial Services. I had to deal with the financial crisis. I will tell you, I went into that committee in 1981 because I care a lot about affordable housing, rental housing. I've always felt that we make a mistake by insisting that the only good form of housing for low-income people is ownership. Decent rental housing is the most appropriate form for many people, if we do it right. And I also cared a lot about the international financial institutions, the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund, because I wanted very much to have them be more supportive of fairness. My crusade has been to show that you can have both domestically and internationally good economic growth and fairness, that you don't have to beat down poor people and low and middle income people to have a greater gross domestic product. And then I became, by virtue of the seniority system in 2003, the senior Democrat on the committee. And at that point, you know, when you're anything but the chairman or the leader, the minority leader in effect, you can pick and choose what you want to work on. But when you become the leader, then it's all on your plate. And I spent much of the years beginning with 2007 learning about things in which I had previously not had an interest and which I am looking forward to ignoring.
Things like derivatives and...
Well, you're exactly right. I have been singing in my head, not aloud because I have a terrible voice, my version of an old anti-war song, some of you remember, Ain't Gonna Study Derivatives No More. But I had to learn it all in self-defense. But here's the deal. In 2005 and 6, when I was the senior Democrat, well, I started in 2003. From 2003 to 2007, those 4 years, I was the senior Democrat, the minority of the committee. The Republican chairman were Jim Leach of Iowa and Mike Oxley of Ohio. And we differed and we worked well together. We would negotiate. They had more votes than I did, but we tried to work things out. At some point I would say, look, I can't be with you. And other times we would try. Then I became the chairman in 2007. In 2007 and 2008, I was the chairman of the committee under the administration of George W. Bush. Let me tell you something about your own great congresswoman, one of America's great leaders, Nancy Pelosi is, in history. And in 2008, George W. Bush approached Nancy Pelosi and said, the economy is hurting. Maybe it was late 2007. We need a stimulus. Isn't that interesting? By the way, they called it a stimulus. I love Nancy, and she's one of our great leaders, and she's very focused on how you do the policy right and you do the marketing as well. And one of the things that they do, my Democratic leaders, is have focus groups. And apparently they had a focus group, and I was puzzled. They had a focus group, and as a result of that focus group, when we were trying to help the economy in 2009, they decided that they would not call it the stimulus bill, they would call it the recovery bill. That's why you see these references to the American Recovery Act. And my response was, that is very puzzling, because in my experience, most people would much rather be stimulated than recover. But I was outvoted, so it's the recovery bill. But Nancy Pelosi and Harry Reid worked with George Bush to provide a stimulus. And Nancy said this. She said, look, we want to help the economy. Now, this is the beginning of 2008, the beginning of a presidential election year. Would have been better for the Democrats if the economy was not doing well. But that's not the way she thinks and the way most of us think. You don't have the people we most care about suffer economic damage. So she said, and remember we had these conversations, she said, look, we would prefer to spend more on highways, to give more money to local governments to hire people, but Bush won't accept that. So here's what he'll do. He only wants tax cuts, but I will make sure in my negotiation with him that they are the most progressive tax cuts possible, that they will be a greatest benefit to people. The less money you have, the more you'll benefit from these tax cuts, including what's called a refundable provision, whereby people at the low end would get money back for the Social Security they paid. And she and Harry Reid delivered a stimulus at George Bush's request. Then, later that year, George Bush sends Secretary Henry Paulson, as Dan mentioned, and Federal Reserve Chairman Ben Bernanke. By the way, Ben Bernanke, whom the right wing is now demonizing, was 3 times appointed by George Bush to high economic positions. Bush made him chairman of his Economic Advisors Council, then he made him a governor of the Federal Reserve, then he made him chairman of the Federal Reserve. Ben Bernanke is a creature of George Bush. He's a very able guy. And to see the right wing attack him and see, frankly, some of these Bush Republicans leave him hanging is very disappointing to me, because he's their guy. But they came to us in September 2008 and said, the economy is about to collapse. Will you Democrats pass for this Republican administration 1 month before the presidential election, 2 months, a massive spending bill called the TARP, which gives us all this discretion. We said, well, we can't give you quite as much discretion as you want, but yes, we have to save the country. So the Democrats in 2008 under George Bush gave him what he wanted. Gridlock begins in 2009 potentially, and there's a very important day in American history, I'll finish in a minute, but it's a mass disease outbreak. January 20th, 2009, Jim had suggested this to me. Widespread amnesia takes over the Republican Party. They forgot where the crisis came from. They forgot who asked for all the bailouts. And from everything then on, it became Obama's fault. Mitch McConnell says, my number one goal is to defeat him. So that's when things break down.
Yeah. Well, you were on the inside of a lot of those meetings, I'm sure. And, as you recall, Lehman Brothers declared bankruptcy. I mean, the sky was falling. There was like hundreds of billions of dollars at stake with the subprime mortgage crisis. And the House actually initially failed to pass TARP because you couldn't get any Republican votes, as I remember. And then the Senate passed it. But what was happening during those? What were those meetings like? Well, I mean, what was the sense of, fear for the economy like?
Very fascinating. In fact, we have a meeting in 2008 in September. But first, you're right. Lehman Brothers failed. And I was actually at a fundraiser in Manhattan with Nancy Pelosi. Jim and I were there and some others. And I was on the phone to Paulson. One of the things that, beginning in 2006 till 2008, I used to hate Friday afternoons because on Friday afternoon after the market closed, I would get another gloom and doom phone call from Paulson. Oh, this is failing. Well, we got a problem here. We got to save this. So he was trying to save Lehman Brothers. I know this from talking to him. He thought he had a deal so that Barclays Bank would take it over. And the regulator of Barclays Bank in England, the Financial Services Authority, said, we're not buying that, which was smarter than the people who let Bank of America buy Countrywide, which was their worst mistake ever. But and in fairness, we'll go back. He tried to save Lehman. Lehman failed. Now, you have to go back to the spring of 2008 when the Bush administration intervened to keep Bear Stearns from going out of business. And what they did was they got J.P. Morgan Chase to take over Bear Stearns with the Federal Reserve, and between them, they agreed to pay the debts of Bear Stearns. Now, this is critical. Paulson's lawyers and Bernanke's lawyers, Bush's guys, told him, when a large financial institution is failing, you can do one of two things. You can pay all of their debts, or you can pay none of their debts. You cannot pick and choose. So they did pay all the debts of Bear Stearns. A lot of the Republicans said, this is terrible. What happened to capitalism? What happened to the free market? Don't ever do that again. So Lehman Brothers fails. Frankly, the Bush administration, I think, makes a greater Paulson. We can't do another Bear Stearns. If you can find somebody else to take it over, okay. So nobody takes over Lehman Brothers. None of Lehman Brothers' significant debts are paid, and the economy grinds to a halt, not just here, but worldwide. And people have talked about how this could have been worse. Could have been as bad as the Great Depression. Could have been worse in this sense. During the Great Depression, you had granularity in the world. Things could be happening in one part of the world different than elsewhere. By 2008, we were all on one grid. And when people said, I'm not lending any, nobody would lend anybody any money. Nobody would give anybody any credit because of that knock-on effect. So then AIG 2 days later said, oh, by the way, we're next. We can't pay our debts, derivatives, credit default swaps. They had no idea how much they owed.
So was there a sense of panic?
Yes, Paulson.
Were people
and
like,
well,
what were the meetings like? I mean, were people screaming?
Paulson and Bernanke came. No, people were very grave. And I will say this. This was Democrats in power, with Republicans present, but Democrats in power, meeting with Bernanke and Paulson, and it was very serious, thoughtful people with a great desire to do what was right for the country, apprehensive and not sure what would work, but everything else got put aside. What's the best we can do? Now, my view as a member of Congress, no matter what I thought, in a situation like this, the executive branch has the initiative. You either go with them or not, but you can't replace what they do, given this modern economy. And it was, okay, we will see. You tell us what you think we need. We will modify it. I mean, we got into an argument with Paulson. We said you had a very strict compensation to the very rich people who were receiving the money, and you had to do something about mortgages. But it was, okay, we got to work together. And that was fairly, we were then negotiating the terms of the deal. I got to say, Paulson, this is piece in his book where he was afraid negotiations were breaking down, and he sent one of his aides to find me because he thought I could help. And it was a very generous, nice, gratuitous gesture. He writes in the book that he found Jim and me having dinner on the third floor of the Capitol, and I went down to try to help out. But we got the thing almost done, and then John McCain appeared in the sky, like Mighty Mouse.
It was at the White House, wasn't it?
Yeah. Here I come to save the day. And he was supposed to be debating Obama on a Friday night, and this is like Tuesday and Wednesday, and we are getting ready to put this thing together, and the Republican leadership said, well, we're not sure we support this. John McCain wants to be involved. And I called Paulson, and others called Paulson, and were very angry. And Paulson was, oh, please don't blame me, and don't take it out on the country. I'm not any happier with this than you. So the result was that John McCain's insistence, George Bush convened this incredible meeting in the White House with the Democratic leadership of the House and Senate, the committee leadership, Republicans and Democrats, Secretary Paulson, John McCain, and Barack Obama. That's when I first began to work with Obama. I'd been a Hillary Clinton supporter, but he and I spoke on the phone. We were all coordinated. And the meeting, the House Democrats, the Senate Democrats, and the Senate Republicans and the administration all said, we got to pull together on this. The House Republicans said, well, I don't know. We don't know what we're going to do. McCain said, I'm with the House Republicans. We said, well, okay, John, what do you want? He wouldn't say. I apparently violated the rule that says you don't speak in the White House unless the president calls on you. Nobody ever told me that rule. They did have some of that got on television. That meeting to get on television. The earlier meeting got on television, in which I was portrayed by, for those of you who remember the old Cheers, I was portrayed by Carla's second husband. He was the man who played me. I did a good job, but it was a small part. But
do you get royalties?
No. Yeah, you don't own that for you in public life. But the what happened was we broke out of that meeting, and McCain wouldn't support the program.
Well, that was really the turning point for the election.
And then he had to do the debate anyway. He was trying to say he could debate.
He backtracked.
And I was like, look, the Democrats and Obama are very much coordinated, but what we weren't thinking electorally. We thought we should coordinate. It was, this country could fall apart. This is terrible. We got to do the best we can. And so the vote comes up, and the Democrats and Republicans had talked, and we said, look, we'll give you a majority of votes, but we knew to pass it, we need a certain minimum of Republicans. And you got what, economists call the free rider problem. The free rider problem is when you know something good is going to happen, and you don't have to pay for it because other people will. You can be a free rider. In other words, you don't have to, it's not like you go to a restaurant and you only eat if you chip in. It's like you go to a buffet that's already been paid for, and you only chip in if you want to. You're a free rider at the buffet, and some people wouldn't do it. So the Republican leadership voted with us, but a group of a number of the Republicans basically said, hey, I think this is a good thing to do. You vote for it, not me. And this is Republicans talking about what a betrayal it was. Some of them, to give them credit, were ideologically convinced this was a bad thing. Look, I had said this. I was quoted in a book by Alan Blinder from the Deputy, the Vice Chair of the Federal Reserve, when Lehman Brothers went under, the Republicans, many of them, had said to Paulson, let free enterprise take over. Don't give us one of these interventions. And I said, okay, so Free Enterprise Day in American history is the day the Lehman Brothers went under and nobody did anything about it. Because the next day it wasn't Free Enterprise Day anymore. It was, oh my God, we can't let that happen again. Let's have another bailout, which they had for AIG. Now, we have since changed the law, by the way, at Paulson's request, initially. Now, if a large institution fails, there are two factors. First of all, we explicitly give the Secretary of the Treasury to pay some of the debts and not all of the debts. That is, only as much as you have to pay to prevent things from spiraling out of control. Secondly, and even more important, not a penny can be done until the institution is put out of business. But Sarah Palin was half right in 2009. For her, that's good, half. She said we had death panels. We did have death panels, but they weren't for old ladies in the health care bill. They were for big banks in the financial reform bill. Not a Lehman Brothers, well, take AIG. AIG was bailed out by the Federal Reserve. In the future, if there was an AIG-type situation, yes, the Federal Reserve might pay some of the debts, or the Secretary of Treasury, but there would be no more AIG. It would be dissolved. But what happened was the Republicans voted no. Interestingly, Eric Cantor, then their number two guy, still, blamed Nancy. He said that Nancy Pelosi had made a partisan speech, and because she'd made a partisan speech, 25 Republicans who were going to vote for it didn't vote for it. I was at a press conference, and I said, well, in other words, you're telling me that there were 25 Republicans who understood that this was good for the country, indeed necessary for the country, and supported on the merits, but Nancy Pelosi hurt their feelings. And so therefore they changed their vote. But I'll give you your answer. What happened was very simple. The stock market the next day dropped 700 points, and that scared them out. And not only that, politically, one other thing. It's the way politics works. We hear from the people who are unhappy. People rarely call up Congress and say, you're doing a wonderful job. Keep it up. I'm all for that. people call up and say, what are you, stop doing this. So what happens is, when it looked like the TARP was going to pass fairly easily, overwhelmingly we heard from people who thought it was a terrible idea. Because the people who thought it was a good idea took it for granted. Yeah. Once it failed, the mail and the phone calls turned around and people called up and said, you're ruining the economy, and that's what switched them.
I do want to talk to you about Dodd-Frank, but since I'm getting the feeling I might not get to ask too many questions, I want to go backwards a little bit. And by the way, there was some news today. The Minnesota State Senate passed gay marriage, and the governor says he's going to sign it. And earlier you were talking about tweets, and Dan Savage had a very funny tweet today. He tweeted, why should Marcus Bachman be the only legally married gay man in Minnesota? But you, no comment. you got married last year. How did that change things for you?
Well, it strengthened an already strong bond. It was a part of it was obviously public. I did want to make sure, and Jim and I, we wanted to make sure that we got married while I was still in Congress. One of the things that makes me feel good is that prejudice wins when nobody knows anything. Prejudice is ignorance. And originally this prejudice thrived because, you know, we were all hiding before people like Ambassador Jim Hormel, a great pioneer who's here with us, and others said, no, I'm who I am and I'm gonna take this public position as who I am. And I felt for members of Congress, many of my Republican colleagues, almost all of them who were voting against marriage, only two in the House and two in the Senate alone, that they needed to be confronted with the reality. And I thought it was very important. And I think the good news is reality will beat prejudice if we show it. But it did mean a strengthening of an already strong bond. It was almost as if, not almost as if, it was probably saying, look, we are so much in love that we're proud of this and we want everybody else to know it and set that example. Yeah. So we're about to have the 10th anniversary of the Massachusetts decision. This fall is the 10th anniversary of the Massachusetts decision. And of course, you know, what I wish the media would do more of is listen to all of the negative predictions people make about any discrimination of any sort and go back 5 years later and document how little...
I think Massachusetts has one of the lowest divorce rates.
The whole structure. I mean, I remember saying this in 1996 when we were debating the Defense of Marriage Act. It's called the Defense of Marriage. The structure of that is, it's like a very popular commercial today. The assumption is that they're defending marriage. There are happily married men all over Massachusetts, married to women. And then they read in the paper that Jim and I get married. And they look at that and they say to themselves, I could have married a guy. And it turns out, that sells juice better than marriage.
So you got elected in 1980 along with Ronald Reagan, and you were not out.
No, I was not.
And you came out, I think, 9 years later.
87 years later.
87. Okay. So what was it like being in the closet?
Well, it was hell, and that's why I did it. I got elected to the state legislature in 72, and I filed the first gay rights bill in Massachusetts history. We were just doing. Stonewall really was a pretty sharp dividing line. There were very few other political movements in America, maybe the Civil War, obviously, for race. But even that took a long time to get started again. I had started coming out in the late 70s. It was awful. You cannot live sort of half in and half out, particularly if you're prominent. You don't have the option of just being out and going about your business. And I found it difficult. I made stupid decisions because of it. Every human being has needs that are emotional and physical that need an outlet. And when you can't find the outlet in a constructive way, at least in my case, it's all my fault. I wasn't being as wise as I should have. And so I started coming out in the late 70s because I looked at the political situation in Massachusetts. I didn't think that the congressman in whose district I lived was going anywhere because he had just become Speaker of the House. I was in Tip O'Neill's district. And I figured, all right, I'm going to come out. I'll be a prominent gay activist who was a former state legislator. And then the Pope intervened because the congressman in the district next to mine was a Jesuit priest named Robert Joynen. And the new Pope, John Paul II, decided that he did not want to have a priest in Congress, particularly, frankly, kind of a liberal one. So he ordered Drynan to leave Congress, or leave the priesthood. Drynan was a lifelong
priest. So they ended up with a gay Jew. That didn't work out so well.
Drynan said that he was never allowed near the Pope, but he would have asked him if he had. Did that work out the way you had thought it was? But I then went back in the cars. I started coming out to friends and families and sort of the retail basis back in the 70s with the Hearts and Flowers playing in my head. And then in 1980, I got to Congress. I said, okay, I got a new start here. I'll be fully out to the gay community in Washington, but I won't say anything publicly. And it didn't work. It's a crazy way to live. And so I just decided I had to come out.
Yeah. Ed, for the benefit of our radio audience, let me just say this is the Commonwealth Club of California program, and we're talking to Barney Frank, former Democratic congressman from Massachusetts, about his decades of public service. You can hear Commonwealth Club programs on the radio and also see video of the programs online at FORA-TV. I'm Scott Schaefer, your moderator for this evening's program. So when you came out, did most of your colleagues in Congress not know?
A lot didn't know. Some did. It's an interesting part about this. The rule for the media then and now, although it's eroding a little bit now, was that you did not identify someone as gay or lesbian unless he or she gave permission, or that individual was involved in an unpleasant and unfortunate situation in which his or her sexuality was central. What that meant was that for a long time, the only elected officials whom people knew to be gay or lesbian were people who did things they shouldn't have done. And I got to say, on behalf of the lesbians, there were more gay guys doing what they shouldn't have done than the lesbians.
Well, and one of them was in the Massachusetts delegation, Gary Studs, right?
Right, and others. Gary, who was brought out by an incident, was the first one to say, okay, I'm gay. The others, there was a series of gay members of Congress who'd been involved in things, all of whom implausibly announced that this had happened when they were too drunk to remember what had happened, which remarkable degree of physical stamina when they couldn't otherwise stand up, according to them.
Although more credible than a wide stance, perhaps.
That's right. But what happened was the media began to ask me in the 80s if I was gay, including some gay reporters. They're not asking if I was gay. Can we write about your being gay? I said, no, not yet. And finally, I was ready to come out. But I didn't want to announce it because I was afraid if I announced it, then I would, at the time, this is 87, I wanted to be able to say that my being gay was no big deal. If you think about it, that's not a great thing. I mean, sexuality is an important part of you. Who wants your sexuality to be no big deal? You want it to be a very enriching and warming part of your life, as it is for me now with Jim. So I said to the Boston Globe, which was the key paper there, if you ask me if I'm gay, I'll tell you yes. They said, well, we can't ask you because our rule is, don't ask.
Don't tell.
So a stalemate went on for a couple of months where they wouldn't ask me because that would violate their rule. Finally, they got worried that somebody else was going to scoop them. So they sent a reporter down to ask me, are you gay? And I gave this very considered answer because I was, again, worried. See, I wanted to be able to say, Edward, it's not a big deal, to minimize it because I was afraid of the political consequences. And I how could I announce something and then subsequently announce that it wasn't important? They said, well, what the hell did you tell us for? Well, it's no big deal. So they asked this reporter, a very able lesbian reporter named Kay Longcope, said, are you gay? And I gave my very considered answer, yeah, so what? And that was it. But the subsequent reaction was wonderful. Alan Simpson of Simpson Bowles called me up the next day, very moving, and said, I joke around a lot. I hope to hell I never made any anti-gay joke to you. Because, you're my friend and you're my pal. Former Senator Warren Rudman, who died, I was in the convenience store in Washington on Capitol Hill, a place called Rowan's. And I was in the back, he was in the front, and he saw me. He was leaving. And in a very loud voice, everybody could hear, said, good for you. So there was almost no problem. There was one member of Congress who announced that he was no longer going to use the House gym because he was AIDS phobic.
Oh, it's because of AIDS, not the showers.
Well, the shower did think about. I debated the shower thing, and don't ask, don't tell. And I used a California quote when people say, "Oh, what about the showers?" And of course, the answer is, if you've lived in America, you've played on a sports team, if you've gone to a gym, if you've you know, gone to school. You have been showering with gay men for years. And I did say in one debate with former Senator Dan Coats, Dan, you and I have been members of Congress for all this time. There are showers in the gym. Do you think I've been having myself dry cleaned? That was the line Alfred Hitchcock used when a man complained to him that his wife had stopped taking showers after Psycho. He said, perhaps you should have her dry cleaned.
So was there any, were there any big, like, disappointments, you know, Democrats, say, for example?
No.
No one?
No, they were fine. Tip O'Neill was a wonderful man and was ahead of his time in a lot of ways. He did tell his press secretary, Chris Matthews of Hardball, was then his press secretary, when the rumors were going around, all right, Chris, we better get ready to talk to the press. They tell me Bonnie Frank's going to come out of the room. What do you mean? He said, oh, he's no closet, Mr. Speaker. He said, oh. No, people were very supportive. But I will tell you one story, you know, fast forward. You know, when I was first going to run for state representative, I was afraid people would find out I was gay and would destroy it. When Jim and I announced our wedding, I had a problem with my colleagues. More of them wanted to be invited than I could accommodate. And but it was very partisan, unfortunately. And one Republican who I was close to said he wanted to come and then didn't show up, and we think it was for political reasons. One Republican member of Congress did send me and Jim, sent to my office, a very lovely picture frame wedding present. And then 2 weeks later, voted to reaffirm the Defense of Marriage Act. And so Jim and I talked, and I brought the present back. And she was a woman, she called, and she said, well, did I do something to offend you? And I said, look, this is, I mean, because you've got to connect the personal to the political.
You know, to what extent, not just on that issue, but, you know, we're talking about gay marriage, but do politicians in Congress do what they believe to be right versus either what they think is politically expedient or what they have to do to avoid, you know, a primary or whatever it is?
Well, party has become more of a factor now, but in general, setting party aside, and I'll get to that, it's better news than people think. The average member of Congress does what he or she thinks is the right public policy, subject to the constraint of electability. And where members of Congress differ is this. There are very few people in elected office who are prepared to commit electoral suicide unless it is a very, very, very important issue. But members of Congress differ in the extent to which they will take any risks. I mean, the people for whom I had no respect were the people who would not do anything that was perceived to be unpopular.
Well, some of them are Democrats.
Oh, absolutely. But most of the members of Congress, as I said, it is to do what they think is the right thing, subject to the constraint of electability. Now, the problem has been, frankly, in the era of YouTubing and big money, people now feel more vulnerable. So there has been a decrease in people's willingness to do something that's politically unpopular.
You know, you said earlier that you were a big Hillary Clinton person, and you supported her in the primary in Massachusetts, I know, which Barack Obama, I believe, won. But she won?
We won.
Yeah, well, anyway, that's not the point. You know, her husband, of course, signed DOMA, signed Don't Ask, Don't Tell, you know, and Obama has spent, you know, a good chunk of his time undoing some of those things. I know Bill Clinton has had he's reversed himself now on DOMA and all that, but you know, at the time, I mean, is that an example of what you were just describing? That somebody doing what was expedient?
Bill Clinton is an unsung hero of gay rights, including appointing Jim Hormel at a time when that was a very controversial element.
But how do you explain DOMA and Don't Ask, Don't Tell?
First of all, Don't Ask, Don't Tell, very simply. Bill Clinton promised when he was running for president that he would abolish the ban on gays in the military by executive order. He became president and immediately Colin Powell announced that he was against doing this. He was then the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. And while he was theoretically subject to Clinton's control, he was retiring in June. So Clinton couldn't make him do anything he didn't want to do. At that point, a bill
was... He could have let him resign.
Yeah, and it would have made an even bigger splash against it politically. But what happened specifically was this, and I'm glad I have a chance to explain this, because it's unfair to blame President Clinton at all. There was a very important bill for the labor movement and the women's movement, the Family and Medical Leave Bill, a bill that mandated that employers of people above 50 give people family leave or medical leave if they need it, unpaid, but you wouldn't have to quit your job to take care of a parent And that bill was coming up in the Senate. It was the number one priority for organized labor and for the women's movement, and it had been defeated under George Bush wouldn't sign it, George W. Bush. A very homophobic, bigoted Democrat named Sam Nunn from Georgia hooked up with Bob Dole, the Republican leader, and they announced that when that bill came up, they were going to add an amendment to it that took Don't Ask, Don't Tell and made it statutorily binding. And Bill Clinton would then have had this dilemma, because they had the votes for it, unfortunately, and they would have had the votes in the House. And there was this dilemma, because if that bill had passed with that on there, Clinton could have vetoed it only by denying the labor movement, the women's movement, the number one choice, or signing it with this being statutory. They then tried to negotiate a deal that was less onerous. And I was in on those negotiations. At one point, Colin Powell said he would sign on to something that was not so bad if any, at least one other of the chiefs of staff would join them. None of them would. The late Les Aspin, Secretary of Defense, tried to do this. So in the end, the Don't Ask, Don't Tell was marginally better than the existing policy. It was the best Clinton could do over his, over their objections. As to, but what Clinton then did, and I don't, you know, this is the media, this is what happens. The next year, because I worked with Clinton on this, Clinton did something that was frankly even more important for the lives of many gay and lesbian people. In 1954, Dwight Eisenhower promulgated an executive order that said if you were a homosexual, you couldn't get security clearance. Under no circumstances, you couldn't get security clearance. It affected people working for the government or people working for law firms, architectural firms, engineering firms, with contracts with certain government agencies. Bill Clinton abolished that. In 1994, he put out a new executive order saying sexual orientation won't count. He also, for the first time, had Janet Reno announce that if you were gay, lesbian, or transgender, and you lived in a foreign country, and you were being persecuted, you were eligible for asylum in America. And finally, he said, we won't discriminate based on your personal characteristic. He strongly supported ENDA. Then, in 1996, the Hawaiian Supreme Court looks like it might do marriage. They backed off. Bob Dole, once again, now a candidate for president, comes up with the Defense of Marriage Act. It passes the Senate with 12 votes against it. Some of you may have great feelings for the late Paul Wellstone, a very committed liberal, who voted for the Defense of Marriage Act in October of 1996, because he was sure he would lose. Where? In Minnesota, it just went for same-sex marriage. So I do not think Clinton, by the way, it would have passed, sadly, over his objection. I mean, it passed both houses by 3-1 majorities. I fought against it. But on the other hand, he did repeal the executive order on security clearance. He strongly supported non-discrimination and did a number of things that moved forward. And President Obama has also been very good, but repealing Don't Ask, Don't Tell was not on the agenda early on. And we got it done. President Obama got it done because Nancy Pelosi made it a very high priority. And I say that because I was Nancy's deputy in that. But this was Nancy Pelosi's initiative. Basically what happened was the Senate, we had passed a defense spending bill that included a repeal of Don't Ask, Don't Tell, and we sent it to the Senate. And the Senate then announced that, okay, yeah, that's a good idea getting rid of Don't Ask, Don't Tell. Here's what we'll do. We'll pass two separate bills, one for all the money that we need and then for repealing Don't Ask, Don't Tell. And you send us only the defense bill without it, and we'll pass that, and then we'll pass Don't Ask, Don't Tell, and send it to you. And Nancy Pelosi's heritage came forward in a verbal version of a gesture that I gave it. You couldn't see it on the radio. And she empowered me, and we told them, no, that's not going to happen. You have got to pass Don't Ask, Don't Tell repeal, or you don't get a military bill. And that's what happened.
Yeah. We got some questions here from the audience that I want to read, and not surprisingly, a number of them are about Dodd-Frank, the financial reform bill that you co-authored. What do you think of the way they being Congress, are removing the teeth of the financial legislation you sponsored? Will it still be effective?
Well, first of all, Congress is not removing the teeth. The
regulators.
The Republicans in the House tried, and they haven't removed them yet. They haven't fully installed them. They're still teething. Here's the problem. The biggest single problem is this. Derivatives was the major area where there was not any significant regulation. The structure by which derivatives are regulated is a terrible one. You have the Securities Exchange Commission, the financial regulator, Commodity Futures Trading Commission, the farmers. I would have liked to put them together. It was politically impossible, farmers versus the financial interests in terms of Congress. They are trying to work together. But what the Republicans did when they took the House was to refuse to fund adequately those two agencies. So the fundamental problem has been that the Commodity Futures Trading Commission has given this enormous increase in authority over derivatives and no new staff. And that's been part of the problem. Other than that, they are moving ahead. And they have been slow to make decisions, but they haven't made a bad one yet.
Yeah.
And part of it is there are new regulators in town now, and the Obama regulators are very good people.
Yeah. There was an article in The Nation, which I'm sure you saw or heard about last week, describing the armies of lobbyists who have...
And they haven't won one yet.
They haven't won one yet.
I read that article.
They've spent, I think, was it $600 million lobbying?
Well, first of all, they spent that much
lobbying
money.
Lobbying the regulators.
They spent that money on us, and they didn't win big. And I wrote back, and I said, yes, that fight's still going on. I understand that. But no one can point to a specific regulation that's been adopted in weakened form. There's one other problem we've had. And this is where the filibuster comes in. The D.C. Circuit used to be, that's the federal circuit court for the District of Columbia, which gets a lot of the federal regulatory things sent to it. Now, in old days, my old college roommate is here, Charlie Huffman, he was there when that was a great bastion of liberalism with Judge Bazelon and other people. Under the previous years, given the way the dice fell, the conservatives have taken over that court. And they have on several occasions now, in a bout of judicial activism, thrown out rules adopted by the regulators. For instance, the Commodities Futures Trading Commission, under the law which we passed, put a limit on the amount of a commodity you can own if you had no conceivable use for the commodity. Now, why would you buy up a lot of something that you didn't want to use, except to drive the price up? It's speculation. And they call it position limits. And they adopted a rule imposing position limits on oil, for example, and the court threw it out. Basically said, oh, that's not good economics. So it's been those combination of things that have slowed it down. But I wrote to that guy in The Nation, and he hasn't shown me one case where those lobbyists have succeeded.
Was it a mistake, or maybe you didn't have any option, and that's just the way it's done, but was it a mistake to write the law in a way that the regulators wrote up all of the rules?
No option for a couple of reasons. First of all, you have to have some flexibility in these rules. These rules, you can't write in 2010. Changing the law is very hard. By the way, we put in more detail than they did in the New Deal. I mean, we got criticized from both sides. It happens. One, the bill was too long, people said, and two, it was too short. I mean, that, when you say that we left too much to the regulators. But the other thing, too, is this. The more specific you are in a rule, the easier it is to evade. You know, it's the old story. Don't you tell your kid not to put a pencil in his ear. He can put it in his nose. He can put it in his he jabs in his hand. I mean, you have to give them the general parameters and have them fill them out. But I think that's going to work out well. Now, there is one. I'm a little worried about risk retention, the requirement that you not make loans and then sell the loan without keeping part of it back. And I've been working with Sheila Bair, who is another Republican appointee. I got to tell you one story. I'm sorry. This is very important. Okay. People should know this. Sheila Bair was the head of the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, appointed by George W. Bush, and she was very good. She was a better regulator than the Bush people wanted and than some of the Obama people wanted. She had a great influence in writing the bill. But people need to know how she got appointed. In 2004, George Bush named to be the head of the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation a woman named Diana Taylor, who's a very smart woman who was the bank commissioner of New York State at the time. She's also the social companion, as she is described, of Mayor Mike Bloomberg. They're both divorced. There's no scandal there. They've been dating for a long time. When President Bush sent her nomination up to the Senate, the National Rifle Association objected to the Bank Commissioner of New York being named a national bank regulator on the grounds that she was Mike Bloomberg's companion and he was their number one enemy, and President Bush, a good Republican, should not be rewarding their number one enemy. Whereupon he went to the Senate and had the nomination withdrawn, but he then had a problem. They'd made a big deal about appointing a woman regulator, which they were entitled to because it's been a terribly all-male bastion. So they then had to find a woman bank regulator, Republican, not the D.C. in the league. So they found Sheila Bair, who'd been a Bob Dole assistant. She got much more liberal than they thought, and she got the appointment.
Yeah. Whoops. Here's another question. I've never seen the kind of disrespect shown to the president by the Republican Party. How would you handle it if you were Obama? And I would ask, what do you think, where does race come in on that?
Race is a factor, there's no question. I think in particular, it is inconceivable that this stupidity about his birth would have survived. By the way, the one thing, and I don't understand why this didn't just end at all, I don't care where you're born, if your mother is an American citizen, you're an American citizen. He could have been born on the moon and be an American citizen. I mean, it's just utterly bizarre. Not so much with your father, you know, we follow that old matrilineal thing, which I know we've actually changed that now some, but I think the race was a part of it. But not entirely. Look, these were people who also tried to destroy Bill Clinton. I mean, you know, one of the worst assaults on democracy ever was the attempt to drive Bill Clinton out of office because of a personal, misdeed that...
Which resulted from the Whitewater investigation, right? That's how that started. Special prosecutor.
They started it, but when Kenneth Starr testified before the Judiciary Committee in 1998, I'm glad I have a chance to mention this, he had been asked to investigate Whitewater, the FBI files, the travel office, the suicide of Vince Foster, and Monica Lewinsky. And before the congressional elections in 1998, he said to Congress, this man should be convicted of impeachment because he lied about Monica Lewinsky. He then came before us and said, oh, by the way, on Whitewater, the FBI files, the travel office, and Vince Foster, nothing bad. I got nothing. He exonerated him from that. I asked him the question, I said, at what date did you exonerate the president on the travel office? He said, well, actually never, because there was never anything that implicated him. So it should be very clear that this is the worst blatant partisanship by Starr to withhold these. So they just...
So you think it's part of the same strain?
Some of it is that. Some of it is that you have these people who just do not believe in government. Look, we had this... When George Bush comes to us in 2008 through Paulson and Bernanke and says... We're in terrible trouble. I mean, oh, geez, we believe in government. We have this responsibility. But if you don't believe in government, if you are, to take a name at random for the Commonwealth Club, Grover Norquist, and you think that government should be put in a bathtub and shrunk,
drown.
Then you have, there's nothing on your side of it. I didn't like a lot of what George Bush said. I didn't dislike him personally. But I respect for the presidency. It was recognition that a functioning presidency is essential if we're going to have a government that can improve the quality of lives of people in ways that the private sector can't do. They don't believe that. They don't have that to hold them. And I do think the race added some to it.
But where were they when, you know, there was the prescription drug expansion and the wars? And why were they silent then?
Oh, well, the wars they were all for, although it's interesting. One of the most encouraging things going on in America now is the American people have finally caught on to the fact that with the ending of the Cold War, even with terrorism, there is no existential threat to America's existence, and therefore the level of military spending we have been engaging in is far in excess of what we need or what can be usefully employed. And I am very encouraged by that, because I think the key, there is a way to reduce our deficit over time, not right away. Paul Krugman is, of course, right. We should not be cutting the deficit now. We're hurting the economy by doing that. But a year from now, if things go well, if we had our way, you could stabilize it now. We are wildly overextended on the military. We're still fighting the Cold War. We're still protecting Western Europe from Stalin. I mean, we never stopped doing anything. The largest air force in the world is the United States Air Force. I'm very glad of that. It should be. But the second largest air force in the world is the United States Navy. I don't think the Navy is going to go to war with the Air Force. I don't think they both have to keep building up. But I think you now see the right wing bought into that. But I think you're now seeing a conservative, liberal potential coalition to cut it. But where were they? Well, in fairness to the conservative Republicans, they didn't like the drug expansion. That, you remember, they had to keep the House open for 6 hours, the roll call, to budget it through. And what then also happened was the been a steady process since Reagan, and the right wing has taken over the Republican Party. There is no such thing now as a moderate Republican anymore. There were the mainstream conservatives versus the extreme conservatives, and that's actually the most important dynamic going on in America today, politically, is between the more traditional conservatives in the Republican Party and the more extreme ones. And until that gets resolved, we're going to have this terrible gridlock.
Yeah. Another just reminder for the audience that this is the Commonwealth Club of California program. We're talking to Barney Frank, former Democratic congressman from Massachusetts, about his decades in public service. Another audience question here. I'm sure you saw the article yesterday in the New York Times about Maxine Waters, the new ranking Democrat on the committee you once chaired, the Financial Services Committee. And the question is, although no one could ever really replace you, California's Maxine Waters, now the highest-ranking Democrat, yesterday's New York Times interview, she seems to be open to weakening Dodd-Frank, Wall Street reforms that you authored. Can you offer an opinion or perspective on a potential weakening of these much-needed reforms?
Thank you. First, you asked if I'd read the article. I think you can take for granted that any article in the New York Times in which any politician is pictured is one he will have read.
So,
yes, I read it. I don't. What it was doing, I think, was actually a pretty good thing, which was saying, look, she is a very serious, thoughtful, responsible person who is not going to do radical and crazy things. And I will tell you, what she's doing is something what I did. It's almost a military analogy. The right wing controls the House, and she's got to hold the Democrats together. And she's got to hold the Democrats together under great pressure. You know, it's easier to hold them together when you're a majority. When I was chairman of the committee, I could do things that I had the ability to get the Democratic members to do things by working together with them, by helping them sponsor amendments, etc. When you're in the minority, you don't have that same power. The minority leader doesn't have some of the tools that the majority has. You have some. And you then have to pick your battles. And I think what Maxine is doing is what I was doing. When they come up with some plausible, popular, small cutbacks, I didn't fight them either. You go back to higher ground.
Pick your
battles. But she's doing the same thing. And that is, on the major efforts, she's standing there.
Yeah.
And that's an important thing to know. I think she's doing exactly what I would have been doing.
You have an interesting quote in the article. I wrote it down. The article, the author, the reporter writes, "The influential place she, Waters, now holds has been known to nudge the staunchest liberals to the center, including her predecessor, Barney Frank." And then you're quoted as saying, "You make a trade-off when you're at the top of the committee. You gain a lot more influence, but you give up some freedom to speak out."
Absolutely.
What did you mean by that?
Well, you mean that when you are responsible for making the policy and trying to get other people to vote for you, you have to compromise between them and yourself. You can't just, look, there are roles to play. You know, there's a great fun role to play in a legislative body of being the purist and being the one who speaks out. You can play that out outside of the legislative process. I had an argument with Ralph Nader during the financial reform bill, which I'm very proud of, which, you know, I'll cite Elizabeth Warren, who thinks we did a great job, and others. But Nader was attacking us as if we had a magic wand that we could do, and I said to him, "Ralph, you are luxuriating in the purity of your irrelevance." There is a great freedom to say whatever you want. That's okay to do that. That's helpful. But then don't attack other people who have a different role. And the answer is, if your job is simply to articulate what you think is best, go ahead and do it and do it well. And maybe you'll influence people over a longer term. But if your job is to get the votes, to get this bill passed in the foreseeable future, then you have to compromise. You have to give and take. You have to pick out some things that are important to you, and then on things that are not important to you, you work with them. So that's it. And that's the trade-off.
Yeah. Another question, why didn't you run for senator, and why did you leave when you were needed the most? And you lobbied to get the interim senator job when Kerry became Secretary of State, right?
I lobbied to be appointed, not to campaign. I was originally going to retire in 2010, I was just worn out. And Jim and I talked about it, and I said, I'll run again in 2010, but I'm not going to run again in 2012. I'm too tired. I've been doing this for 45 years. And I had always said that I was not going to stay in office beyond the age of 75. I'm 73. I could sneak in another, I'd have a few months before. But first of all, I've seen too many wonderful men and women who gave great service to this country stay too long and become pathetic. And I was determined that I was going to leave when people were still saying, why are you leaving and not why are you staying? And I didn't think it was possible to stay. And you had a recent example. You had a recent example of that here in the Bay Area. I won't mention names. People know who I'm talking about.
You think it's a good thing, by the way? I mean, I won't mention names, but, you know, California has this top two primary now, which, you know, so Democrats who are deemed potentially vulnerable can knock off incumbents who are, you know, less than popular.
Yeah.
Is that a good thing, do you think?
Well, yeah, but you could do that in a primary anyway. I mean, you could have done that even if you just had
well,
in the
it's
past.
Much tougher.
In the past, it could be done in a primary. I don't like letting one party vote in another party's. I think there's elements of mischief. And you had one case where, you know, you wound up with two Republicans and no Democrat when there could have been a better race than Gary Miller's seat. Gary's a friend, but I was sorry to see that. But let me just go back. And me, I was going to retire. And then when the Republicans took the House back, I was afraid exactly that people would say, oh, you're running out when it gets tough. And then I was really trying to get, we had a redistrict in Massachusetts. Everybody has to redistrict in the year after. After the 0 year when the census is done. And for reasons that I don't fully understand, people in the legislature weren't in a mood to be nice to me, and they created my district was kind of a hybrid. They created a very new district for me, which was about 45% new. So it would have meant that I would be running, campaigning among over 300,000 people whom I had not previously represented, and telling them that I wanted to be their representative for 2 years, because all you can do it for one more term. And I didn't feel I could do that. As for running for the Senate, I could not face again that kind of campaign. My nerve endings aren't there. Plus, I think whoever gets elected to the Senate now in Massachusetts should serve out the remaining 2 years of John Kerry's term, and then the next 6 years at least. And I don't think anybody should be elected. I don't think I should be in elected office when I'm 80 years old. I feel very good now. I have no idea how capable I'll be of serving later. So I decided that I would get out now.
What kind of future do you think Elizabeth Warren has? I mean, is she going to be a star in the party or someone who's, you know, like sort of important to liberals but really never...
A star of the party. She's an extraordinarily talented person. I worked very closely with Elizabeth Warren when we did the financial reform bill. I'm very proud of the good things she said. The day that the committee I chaired passed the bill to create an independent consumer financial bureau, she said, they told me not even to try because the banks always win. But they didn't win today. And I'll give you an example about Elizabeth. There's a very good journalist named Robert Kaiser who's written a sort of a very detailed book about how we did the financial reform bill. We gave him access. And he talks about the thing I worked out with the head of the independent community bankers to get them not to oppose the Consumer Bureau, because if they'd opposed it, we would have lost it. The small community bankers in everybody's district have way more power than the big guys. And as he correctly notes, after I worked out this compromise with him, I reviewed it with Elizabeth and a couple of the strongest supporters, and she said, oh, that's wonderful. That's the way it should work. And she has cited that. It was how things should work. She's thoughtful. She's talented. She's articulate. And I would say this. I don't know what Senator Clinton or Secretary of State Clinton plans to do, but if Hillary Clinton does not run for president, I would be willing to bet now that Elizabeth Warren would be vice president. And in any case, she will be... a major factor. She's an extraordinarily talented woman, and she got to the Senate with more accomplishments legislatively than most people have when they get out.
Well, we do have one person in the audience is one person in the audience is calling for a Barney Frank Elizabeth Warren ticket in 2016. But I guess maybe now that you're in Maine, that could be possible.
Don't be sexist if it would be Elizabeth, but I would be too old, and I love Jim, and he's been a great supportive partner, but sticking him in that function, I think, would be cruel and unusual punishment.
Yeah. You think we'll see?
Well, the problem is the White House is very far from the nearest surfing spot.
Yeah, yeah. Do you think we'll see, how long do you think it'll be, or do you think we'll see an openly gay president anytime soon?
Oh, not for 20 years, but I'll tell you this. I began working on LGBT rights, you didn't even call it that then, in 1972 when I filed a gay rights bill. And Jim Hormel and I were just talking about this. If at any time over the last 41 years you would ask me to predict where things would be 3 years later, I would have been too pessimistic. We almost have a Moore's Law going on with LGBT rights, you know, the things double every 2 years. So I honestly don't know. We are making quicker progress than I had thought. It is still the case that a gay presidential candidate would lose, you know, more than enough seats, and But 20 years from now, it could happen.
Yeah. It's extraordinary. Bobby Kennedy in 1968 predicted there'd be an African-American president in 40 years, which is exactly what happened. Pretty amazing.
I'm very proud that his son succeeded me in the House of Representatives.
Yeah.
His son, who was the roommate of Jason Collins, who just came out from the NBA, who said he was inspired to do it because Joe marched in the Gay Pride Parade, which Jim and I marched with Joe on, so I feel very good about that.
What difference, we're almost out of time, but what difference do you think that's going to make? Or is it too soon to tell?
He's coming out enormous. Look, stereotypes shouldn't exist, but they do, and they unfortunately have some reality. I think having a professional athlete like that is very important. I think within the African-American community, where you have a negative influence from some ministers, that many of my congressional colleagues have worked hard to overcome. I'll tell you, the Congressional Black Caucus has had a better record on LGBT rights up until now than even the gay members. Not than the openly gay members, but than the gay members in general. But the CBC has been very supportive, and they've been fighting against this. And having a guy like Collins do this will be very, very helpful.
Well, now I got to ask, how many closeted gay members of Congress do you think there are?
I know of about, there are three or maybe four that I'm sure are...
In the Senate or in the whole Congress?
No, in both. Look, it's not an easy place to be if you're gay. And, you know, people can kind of sort of snuff it out in terms of how you behave. And, you know, at a certain point you're not ever seen with someone from the opposite sex, et cetera. I'm sure of at least a couple of senators and three House members.
Yeah. All right, we'll leave it at that. Congressman, thanks so much for your leadership, and thanks for coming. I'm Scott Schaefer, and this meeting of the Commonwealth Club is adjourned. Yeah, it was fun. Be careful.